From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is U.S. diplomacy under friendly fire? Hello again, I'm Aaron Almy, and this is To the Point. After 6 months of the Trump administration, America's professional diplomats are reportedly desperate for a foreign policy or even for something to do. They complain Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has walled himself off from the diplomatic corps and that he's being walled off from the White House. Ambassadorships and other important jobs are going unfilled, and budget cuts may add to the hollowing out of a veteran staff already depleted by resignations. What's at stake for America's interests and American values around the world? Later on today's Talking Point, as airline seats get smaller and smaller, are you uncomfortable? The FAA officially doesn't care. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Career diplomats say the Trump administration is hollowing out the State Department with no clear foreign policy from the Secretary of State or the White House. Congress already is showing impatience as the president has yet to sign a sanctions bill passed with veto-proof majorities. We'll talk about the implications of all that. Today's talking point, a federal judge has roasted America's air carriers for the incredible shrinking airline seat. Passengers say that's a case for the Federal Aviation Administration, but the FAA says, never mind. First, this update on Trump family relations. The original statement by Donald Trump Jr. about his meeting with a Russian lawyer during last year's campaign said it was all about adopting Russian children. That claim was found to be misleading. Last night, the Washington Post reported that Donald Trump Jr. did not write it. The author was his father, the president, who dictated it on the plane home from the G20 summit in Germany. Scott Horton is a lecturer at the Columbia Law School. Great to have you on our show.
Great to be back.
So Donald Trump Jr. said it was a short introductory meeting. It was all about adoption of Russian children. In fact, he had received a memo promising information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and be useful to your father. It's part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. And Trump Jr. responded, "If it's what you say, I love it," especially later in the summer. So does that suggest that the president himself was covering up?
Well, I think it certainly puts the president much closer to the entire meeting and everything about him. And it shows that he is trying to mislead or misdirect people who are following what went on. And in the process, using almost exactly the same line that he used at that same summit. So remember now, according to this Washington Post report, he dictated this statement on the flight back. And we know at the final banquet, he had a private meeting with Vladimir Putin and his translator that lasted roughly an hour. And he later tells us that that meeting was also about adoption, the adoption issue. So I think these disclosures are going to lead people to believe that he was much more involved in the entire process, and also to be skeptical about what was actually discussed at that final meeting with Putin.
So it then may shed light on a meeting that had been very mysterious so far. Very briefly, if you can, summarize the issue of adoption.
Well, the U.S. responded in the Magnitsky Act and other measures with a series of sanctions against Russia that affected particularly oligarchs and people very close to Putin. These were mostly economic sanctions. This enraged Putin, and he put together a strategy of response and countermeasures. And the first thing he seized upon was to cut off adoptions by American parents of orphans in Russia. So these issues, so whenever you say to a Russian who's engaged with these matters, they discussed adoptions, that would instantly be understood as a discussion surrounding the American sanctions measures.
Okay. Now, some people are suggesting that maybe it was Putin who suggested that what you ought to tell people is what we're talking about is adoptions. That's pretty speculative.
Yeah, we have no direct information for it, but that is what Putin does. So he would tend to use the label of adoptions to cover this entire issue.
So you say that this brings the president closer to the issue. Does it bring him any closer to, once again, allegations of cover-up or even obstruction of justice, or is that just too long a line to draw?
Well, if it were criminal every time a politician issues a public statement that's misleading or factually false, we'd have to put a 12-foot fence around the totality of Washington, D.C. and lock everyone up. It's not. But I think this would have to be understood as just another pebble in a larger mosaic showing an intention to mislead the public about what's going on, and potentially also to mislead investigators both in Congress and in the Justice Department. So I think this greatly complicates the situation for him and puts him much closer to the crosshairs than he's been before.
Leaking, of course, is one of the preoccupations of the Trump White House because there's been so much leaking. Somebody must have been on Air Force One, one would assume, to know that it was the president on his way home from the G20 summit who actually drew this up.
Well, that's exactly right. And in fact, the Washington Post is very clear. It says multiple sources, not just one. So multiple people who were in immediate physical proximity of the president as he did the dictation are their source here. And this is occurring on the day on which a new chief of staff is being announced with a mission of going to war against the leakers. That's the other almost equally astonishing fact to come out of this report.
And, of course, we also know that it was important enough or thought to be important enough for the president of the United States to actually spend time writing out a response, which turned out to be somewhat misleading, as we've heard already.
And it's his decision to do so. So he feels attracted to this. He wants to control it. He wants to dictate all the responses. And the normal instinct, I'd have to say, of any chief of staff would be to keep him as far away from this as possible.
Okay, we'll see what happens in the future and what more we learn about this. Scott Horton, lecturer at the Columbia Law School, many thanks.
Great to be with you.
In a moment, is U.S. diplomacy under friendly fire? This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To the Point. The Trump administration has failed to fill important positions in the State Department. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is cut off from both the professional staff and from the White House. Incoherent policies are undercutting U.S. diplomacy and jeopardizing America's leadership in the world. That's according to more than three dozen current and former diplomats interviewed by Foreign Policy, where Emily Tamkin is a staff writer. Emily, thanks a lot for being on our program today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's break this down a bit. When people say that Secretary of State Tillerson is cut off from the professional staff, what are the details of that?
Yeah, so as my colleagues, I should call them out since they wrote the piece, Robbie Grammer, Dan DeLuce, and Caleb Lynch, as they detail in this piece, there's sort of two ways in which Secretary Tillerson is isolated right now. One is from traditional career diplomats who are in the State Department. That's happened by sort of the way in which he's built up the separate policy planning staff and is looking to reorganize the State Department. And then separately, the State Department is reportedly isolated from the White House and from the foreign policy, I guess they'll call it the decision-making machine.
And what's the evidence for that, the letter?
From the letter? I mean, that's according to State Department officials to whom my colleagues have spoken. I think it's also, you know, pretty clear in terms of the statements that have come out from the White House versus those that have come out from the State Department on a variety of issues.
And is there evidence then that Mr. Tillerson has tried to be heard at the White House and has been rejected in some way or simply not paid attention to?
I mean, certainly there are reports of meetings in which Tillerson is, or I don't want to speak to how he feels, but is sidelined by the White House and by this administration's decision-making process.
At one point, it was reported that he was going to take a little time off. As I understand it, he didn't do that. But is there some suggestion that he might resign?
Yeah, there's been talk of a Rexit by the year's end, which, you know, I don't think necessarily contributes to the stability of the U.S., of American diplomacy in what's already been a pretty unstable year.
What's morale like, then, among the professional diplomats in the State Department?
It's low. To summarize it in one word, it is not high. It's low. You know, which I think if you are, how can I put this? I think if you're someone who sort of dedicated himself or herself to American diplomacy throughout the course of your entire life, and suddenly you're sidelined in this way, I think that would be personally dispiriting and also professionally very frustrating. These are people who got into this line of work presumably because they wanted to contribute to crafting American policy, crafting American diplomacy, and they're sidelined.
Emily Tamkin, once again, staff writer at Foreign Policy. James Dobbins is former ambassador. He's senior fellow and distinguished chair in diplomacy and security at the Rand Corporation now. Held various posts in the State Department and the White House. He has a memoir, Foreign Service, 5 decades on the front lines of American diplomacy. It's just been released. And Mr. Ambassador, welcome as always.
My pleasure.
You've indicated you worked starting with the Kennedy administration all the way through the Bush administration, did you go all the way to Obama? I can't remember.
Yes.
Okay. So a lot of experience, to say the least. Tell us a little bit more about the Foreign Service, these dedicated people that we heard described by Emily Tamkin, and who've been described in a lot of places as people who often have to work under very uncomfortable circumstances, often with their lives at risk.
Well, I think that's all true. I think the Foreign Service does have a tendency to complain, but I think it's more intense this time and probably more justified than it has been historically. Transitions are always a difficult and frustrating period. I went through half a dozen of them, but there's nothing really to compare to this one. I think the Reagan transition was a difficult one, and Reagan actually went through 6 national security advisors. One went to jail, one tried to commit suicide, one left under a cloud, and it really wasn't until toward the end when the White House really stabilized on the national security side. But still, there was a degree of continuity of adult supervision and of consistency of policy that was much stronger then than now.
How can it be worse than jail, suicide, and leaving under a cloud?
I think you of course it ultimately ended up with Iran-Contra midway through his term. So it was a bit tumultuous, and the president acknowledged that he hadn't been fully aware of what his national security team was doing with the Iran-Contra episode. But nevertheless, as I said, I worked in the State Department throughout that period, and felt that we were connected, that we had a good hearing in the White House, and that policy was evolving in general, with some exceptions, in a coherent and controlled fashion.
President Trump promised to clean the swamp. Now what we're hearing, it seems to me, is that particularly with regard to diplomacy, continuity is very important. Tell us more about that.
Well, I think both are important. The new administration has a right and a duty to put its own stamp on policy, but it does have to draw on the historical experience, which is embodied to a considerable degree in the career bureaucracy, not just the Foreign Service, but the Civil Service and the other national security agencies, including the intelligence services. The new administrations bring in new blood. They bring in people from outside, usually people from outside with a strong foreign and national security background. who also draw on the historical experience of the country in crafting the new policies. And you've seen some of that. Certainly there are strong professionals in the White House and at State and at and particularly at the Defense Department. But you have a feeling that they're not as listened to and not as influential, perhaps, as they have been in the past.
Well, you say this, you can't compare this to what's happened in other transitions. What are the consequences of that for foreign policy?
Well, I think we're very fortunate so far that there hasn't been a major consequential disaster. New administrations, however well organized and well staffed, tend to make serious mistakes, particularly when the new president is relatively inexperienced. If you think of John Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs, if you think of LBJ and the decision to extremely reinforce Vietnam, if you think of Bill Clinton and the Somalia Black Hawk Down incident, and of course the worst of all, if you think of George W. Bush and the decision to invade Iraq, all done fairly early in their administrations, all serious mistakes from which they learned and gradually improved. I think given the degree of disarray that we've seen in the last few months, we've been fortunate to avoid something like that, and one can only keep your fingers crossed that we'll continue to do so.
Former Ambassador and State Department and White House Officer James Dobbins. Orville Schell is with us. He's now Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Welcome to you.
Pleasure.
Tell us, if you will, about some of the positions that have not been filled and how important they might be.
Well, I think in the State Department, I mean, one of the sort of key sets of musculature are the Assistant Secretary of States that get appointed by a president, and there are legions of them who've been unappointed. And I think they're instead various foreign service officers have been sort of taking their place. But I think it's fair to say that the Trump administration, not necessarily Secretary Tillerson, has a bias against these sort of professional diplomats because, in effect, their loyalty is to diplomacy, rule of law, and to sort of a higher calling than simply a president's whims. And so he wants to appoint his own people. Slowly, I think he will do that. But in the meanwhile, we have a very defoliated landscape. So some key elements of where, you know, the country's embassy would relate to Washington through these assistant secretaries and deputy assistant secretaries has been missing since Trump came on duty.
So does that mean then that relations with other countries are sort of at a standstill?
Well, it means that, you know, there's not only this sort of these missing links, but also there is a kind of a chaotic policy. So, I mean, diplomats are best when they have a policy sort of agreed upon and handed down that they then affect in the name of the United States. Policy has been wandering all over the map in relation to China. We had a love-in in Mar-a-Lago with Xi Jinping and President Trump, and now things are really cooling and Trump is starting to tweet rather anti-Xi messages out. And so we're on again, off again, on again. It makes it very difficult, I think, for professional diplomats to know exactly what it is they're supposed to do. And I think we see the effects of this, that a kind of a withering of the sort of basic day-to-day functions of intergovernmental relations.
What about Russia and the fact that the Congress, dominated by Republicans, of course, has passed by veto-proof majorities bills that would sanction Russia and prevent the president from lifting those sanctions against Russia or anybody else?
Well, I mean, this is a completely unheard-of thing where the Russians have just banished 700-odd American diplomats from Moscow, which further will complicate the ability of the State Department to interact in an effective way with Russia at precisely the time when things are most tense and most in need of some sort of attention. So I think we see this both in the case of China and Russia, where we have two of the biggest embassies and two of the most important countries fraught with the most tensions. We find ourselves in a very sort of attenuated position to actually transact the business that has to go on to keep the two countries in a stable relationship.
Orville Schell at the Asia Society, you've used the term unheard of. Ambassador Dobbins, you've used the term can't compare with other transitions in terms of the chaos and difficulty. You said that we're lucky that so far there hasn't been any major disaster. What major disaster might you predict as a result of what we're seeing?
Well, I think the situation with North Korea is quite dangerous. I think we might stumble into a wider conflict in Syria, and tensions are rising in Europe. I do think that there are islands of competent policy execution in this administration. I think the counter-ISIS campaign has been quite successful. I think the efforts to deconflict with Russia in Syria and to actually negotiate some stabilization arrangements there has been well conceived and well executed. And so I think this team can perform adequately when it concentrates on it, but that requires a degree of discipline and concentration over time on a variety of hotspots, and I don't see that everywhere.
Let me go back to our first guest, Emily Tamkin, staff writer for Foreign Policy. Yours is a relatively specialized magazine, but you are a reporter and you have a broader audience than just those interested in that. Do you think that Americans in general are very concerned about foreign policy and about the kinds of issues that we're talking about?
You know, I think they are, first of all. I think this idea that Americans aren't interested in the world around them is sort of an unfair stereotype. But even if they're not, I think they should be. And that's for two reasons. The first is that the issues that we're discussing right now, be it North Korea, be it Russia, issues that we're not talking about right now, be it, you know, the potential of a trade war with Canada, all of those things are going to affect American citizens in very real, very tangible ways in their everyday lives. So, you know, if it's the threat of war with North Korea, if it's you know, if we start a trade war with China in an effort to punish them over North Korea, that's going to affect American citizens. If we get into a fight with Canada over, I don't know, lumber or dairy, that's going to affect people, and not just coastal elites. But I would also, you know, Russia is a major nuclear power. I don't want to threaten your listeners with nuclear war, but to get them to care about foreign policy. But I do think that is relevant to our quality of life. But I would also say that, you know, the positions that the U.S. government takes, and maybe this is a bit simplistic, but it really does impact people throughout the world, all over the world, right? The international order that exists now was set up in large part by the United States. The policies the United States pursues or does, it impacts people there. And so I would encourage the average American listener to your program, the average American reader of foreign policy, or the average reader of foreign policy, to consider that there are average people in every country, and that the diplomacy that's pursued or isn't by the United States impacts those people.
Orville Schell, we just have a couple of seconds until we go to a break, and I can give you more opportunity to respond to this question if you want. But is it possible, given the complexity of the world, for anybody to come into office and have a set of policies that they can just lay down that are going to make everything happen smoothly and cleanly?
No, I think it's a very fraught world and a very complicated world. But generally speaking, when a new administration comes in, they may have some new policy or tweaks to policy. They don't sort of rip it up, lay it down, and then rip it up again. And I think there are some cases where I think the Trump administration has done all right. But I think in the case of China, which is perhaps the most important relationship we have, we see a very hot and cold, a very idiosyncratic kind of a management of the policy, done on top of the fact that we have some whole layers of our professional diplomatic corps missing.
Okay. Again, we're talking about the State Department under the Trump administration, its first 6 months, and we'll continue the conversation after we take a brief break on our talking point later as airline seats get smaller and smaller. Are you uncomfortable? The FAA officially doesn't care. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled.
This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Ollie back with To the Point, talking today about a State Department in the first months of a new administration that is said to be confused and operating in a way that is unheard of, despite the fact that transitions often are unclear. We have a Secretary of State who's himself not very experienced, cut off from both the professional staff of the State Department and the White House itself, as we have just heard, a fraught world. Peter Freever is with us. He is a professor of political science at Duke University, served in both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations on the National Security Council staff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, if you will, a little bit more, if you can, about what this means in terms of foreign nations, and what are they supposed to think, given the circumstances that we've just heard described?
Well, our partners around the world, our friends and cooperative partners, prefer stability and predictability. Especially if we're going to disappoint them in some area, they'd like to know about it in advance so that they can adjust. And they have a very hard time reading this administration thus far. So a lot of confusion on the trip to Europe about the extent of the president's commitment to Article 5 and the NATO defense commitment. There's a lot of uncertainty in Asia about the extent to which the United States will honor its security obligations there. And this uncertainty is unsettling. And that's our friends. Now, the president has made a big point of saying uncertainty is good when you're dealing with adversaries, so they can't game you. And it is the case that President Obama was pretty predictable, and our adversaries took advantage of that, particularly in the last several years. So the benefit of unpredictability is supposed to come with our adversaries, but if so, it's probably – we haven't seen much of it yet, and I think what we've seen is more instability, and with relations with some of our key adversaries are worsening, and North Korea's situation, of course, being the most obvious one.
One thing we haven't talked about at all is the relationship between the civilian and military authorities in the country. While it appears that the State Department may be rather drastically cut financially, the Defense Department, of course, is being increased, and we have now a general becoming the chief of staff of the president, and not just one of the very unsettling things that's been going on there. Peter Freever, how important is that, and is there a kind of imbalance that's being created?
I think there is a danger of an imbalance. Each of the generals and retired generals, Kelly is retired, but H.R. McMaster, who's the current National Security Advisor, is still in uniform, still an active duty three-star, serving in what is usually a civilian position. Each one of those appointments can be defended on its merits. There is a good appointment, and I would say maybe an improvement over previous ones or alternatives that have been suggested in the press. So it's not an objection to any single one, but to the accumulation, then there's a concern, especially when you couple it with what you were talking about before the break, which is a weakness in the State Department voice. And then that's the imbalance I worry about. If it was this team on the military side with an equally powerful State Department, sort of headed by Jim Baker, with all the clout that he had in the heyday, well, that would be that would be a different story. But right now, State Department is late and slow to the table in the interagency, and so that may contribute to this imbalance.
You were on the National Security Council staff in a couple of administrations. Are you hearing the same things that we've heard from our other guests and that we've heard reported by Foreign Policy magazine, that professional diplomats are, in fact, feeling very much at sea, ignored, and are they, in fact, resigning in large numbers?
Well, I think Ambassador Dobbins had it right when he said that there's never been a time when professional diplomats didn't feel that their voice was adequately heard. There's almost a congenital desire on the part of the State Department to have a bigger role than the one they currently have. That being said, their role today is low by historical standards. And so the concerns today, while familiar and while echoing with what we've heard in the past, I think they're more heartfelt and perhaps more grounded. That's the first point. The second point is it's not as if there's no precedent. So I think what the administration, what Tillerson is aiming for, is something like the strong central office that Secretary Baker had, where he ran things from the seventh floor, and where the rank and file were perhaps not as empowered as they might have been in other configurations. I think that's where Tillerson wants to go. I don't think he's arrived there yet because he doesn't have his confirmed political appointees all in place yet. But in 6 months from now, if they are, we might see something like the Baker model. That's where he wants to go, I believe.
Back to Emily Tamkin at Foreign Policy Magazine. You've described, or your magazine has described, the situation on the seventh floor with the Planning Commission people taking over. I take it nobody seems to know who they are.
That's my understanding, is that, you know, there's this divide between who's there or who's going to be there and sort of the career diplomats. But I would also just add in that so I cover embassies for foreign policy, and something that I've heard in the past, 7 months is, we're just waiting for the people that we need to talk to. There are some holdovers from the previous administrations, but we're waiting for the right people to be appointed. We're waiting for, it's just that there's someone to answer the phone, but we need the person to craft the policy so that we know who the person is. And that I would just, suggest that a survey about State Department reorganization or, a plan for an expanded policy planning office, that's not going to give answers to the people who then need to go back to their governments and give them answers.
Let me go back to Ambassador James Dobbins again, who has served in every presidency since between John Kennedy and Barack Obama. Are you concerned, as Peter Feaver suggested he was as well, about the imbalance that might be occurring between the State Department and the Defense Department?
Well, Peter, I think I'd rather have the people that are currently, the generals that are currently in office than many of the alternatives that have been suggested. I do think that probably President Trump has in his mind a caricature of what American diplomats are. You know, people in striped pants who go to a lot of cocktail parties and are part of the elite that he campaigned against, as opposed to people who represent America very broadly, mostly come from middle America, operate in very dangerous circumstances, take the same chances, and suffer the same casualties as our military does in many places. So I think that's unfortunate. But you could do worse than McMaster, Mattis, and Kelly, and I think we're all grateful that they're there.
Orville Schell, we now have a general as chief of staff of the White House. The last time we had that was during the Nixon administration. Now, how do you feel about the dominance of military officers, even if they are better than the alternatives that seem to be available at the moment?
Well, I think the last point is worth making, that I think the people we now have are as good as you get within this administration. We forgot we also had another general, Flynn, head of the NSC, who quit over the Russia scandal. It's a bit out of balance, to be sure, particularly of a president who campaigned against generals and against the military, suddenly relying on them. But I think, if you turn to a place like the embassy in China, which is absolutely critical, we've just had the resignation of David Rank, the deputy chief of mission, who was running the embassy. I mean, talk about key middle-level people because he simply couldn't work with the Trump administration. I think this is a very bad sign, and the people that I know in the State Department are very dispirited. Many of them are leaving, and younger people are really questioning whether this is the sort of organization generation of the kind of career ladder that they want to subscribe to, a one that used to be very reliable, now seems to be much more marginalized and heading into rather uncertain territory.
Peter Feaver, once again, a veteran of the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. How important is it that people of the sort we just heard described are leaving? And are there people who are unwilling to replace them even when they're asked?
Well, I think the administration has had difficulty in filling slots, finding people who have not said negative things about Donald Trump during the campaign, didn't sign the letters. Full disclosure, I signed the letter, so I'm disqualified from service. But even people who tweeted or wrote op-eds, like Elliot Abrams, he didn't sign the letters but wrote a critical op-ed, they've been disqualified as well. So one of the challenges is that the Trump administration began with a thinner list because of these considerations, and then you make it harder if the place is viewed as morale is low, questions about loyalty are low. I think if Scaramucci had not been fired, I think that would have had a chilling effect on people going in. Someone could backstab as he did in the New Yorker article and get away with it. I think that would have made it harder to recruit new people. So there is a challenge in recruiting. That being said, as Ambassador Dobbins made clear, there's some great people coming in, not just the ones that have been mentioned, but at lower levels. I think Brian Hook, who's at Policy Planning at State Department on the 7th floor, he's very good. There's good people. They're just very, very slow. They're about 6 months behind where they should be. And so in some sense, we have to wait and see a year for 6 months from now, when they have the full team assembled, were they able to overcome the recruitment challenges I've just mentioned?
Orville Schell, when we talk about Anthony Scaramucci, we're talking about White House communications. And while we're talking about White House communications, what about the tweets? And what's the impact of the presidential tweets on foreign policy?
Well, you have to wonder whether any chief of staff is going to be able to control the White House staff members if the head of the staff, the president himself, is sort of wandering off the reservation several times a day or at night and tweeting whatever he wants without any consultations. I mean, this throws a tremendously centrifugal force into the whole notion of policy planning, which actually takes a lot of consideration. It takes agreement, and then things trickle down and people execute. But it's precisely that sort of food chain which has now been disrupted by the very erratic behavior of the current president.
Ambassador Dobbins, do we in the media pay too much attention to the tweets, or given that they come from the president of the United States, is there any way to avoid them?
I don't think there's any way to avoid them, and they often prove authoritative, at least in the foreign policy area. I mean, sometimes he backs off and he'll consider a tweet, but by and large, they represent where policy is going to go. So I don't think they can be ignored. On the other hand, I do think that there is a degree of continuity and the permanent bureaucracy does provide some degree of consistency to policy. So the mood is one of uncertainty, a concern about the consistency of policy, as Peter and others have indicated, that essentially means that the world is without a leader at the moment. That on a number of issues, there isn't the Western world isn't coalescing around a policy. For instance, how to deal with Russia's election interference. It's not just an American problem. Russia's doing it in Germany. It's doing it in France. It's doing it in several other countries. And we should have a concerted approach. But we can only get a concerted approach if the administration takes the lead, works with Congress, and then takes a tough line. In consultation with the other major allies, so that any sanctions regime, for instance, is much more meaningful if it was done collectively rather than unilaterally, and particularly unilaterally in a way that also sanctions some of our allies.
We have a short time left. Let me ask you all the same question and ask for as brief an answer as you can deliver. Ambassador Dobbins, you said, thankfully, we haven't had any major disaster yet. Does the situation we're talking about make the U.S. more vulnerable than it needs to be?
Potentially. I mean, if we're challenged, will we be able to pull together a concerted Western response to a challenge in a way that avoids unnecessary escalation and yet carries the day? We'll just have to wait and see.
Professor Fever, same question to you.
It is a risk, but it's worth noting that President Trump has not fallen into escalation spirals yet, despite remarkable provocations from North Korea, from Russia, from elsewhere. He has not over-responded yet, and that was something critics worried about.
But are we more vulnerable?
Well, we are more vulnerable because America's position in the world is weaker than it should be. So, yes, until that position is repaired, we are vulnerable.
Orville Schell, same question.
Well, we will be challenged. One can count on that. And the key to meeting a challenge is not simply how the U.S. will respond unilaterally, but whether it has the sort of moral standing and the leadership acumen to pull others in the world in behind it to make a united front. And this is where I think the Trump presidency leaves a lot of question marks.
Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. Orville Schell, again, Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Peter Fever, Professor of Political Science at Duke, formerly with the Clinton and George W. Bush National Security Council staffs. Former Ambassador James Dobbins, who served every president since between John Kennedy and Barack Obama in the State Department and the White House. He's now at the RAND Corporation. And Emily Tamkin with Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks to you as well. Great to have you all. Do come back and talk to us again. Airline coach seats are more uncomfortable than ever. Is there any relief in sight? We'll find out in a moment on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney here with today's talking point. Judge Patricia Millett on the prestigious Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., has issued a blistering decision about what she called the case of the incredible shrinking airline seat. She ruled in a case brought by outraged passengers in FlyersRights.org against the Federal Aviation Administration. So you'd think that the FAA might have to take action. Joe Brancatelli is a business travel columnist. His blog is called JoeSentMe.com. Joe, glad to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be with you. And you scored the key commentary there with the case of the incredibly shrinking airline seat. Makes us all think of Perry Mason, I think.
Well, that was the judge's phrase. And it's once again, she issued a pretty nasty opinion indicating that maybe she has to fly coach and it's pretty uncomfortable.
And she's certainly not wrong. What I thought was most interesting about her decision and her ruling was that it was written from the point of an aggrieved passenger. It was not quite the kind of judicial decisions that tend to come down in somewhat dry legalese. This was written, as you say, your exact quote was blistering. And again, the ruling starts with the case of the incredibly shrinking airline seat. The one problem is she has no power to make the FAA act.
So why is that? We think that judges do have the power under these circumstances if, in fact, somebody complains about something, if they find the complaint to be correct, they can order the government to do something about it.
Well, what she did do was what she could do, which was order the FAA to look at the situation again and consider making rules. But that's the limit of her power in this situation. And there's simply no indication that the Federal Aviation Administration, which wouldn't even give up documents because they claimed they were proprietary and would offend airline manufacturers and airlines, will reconsider anything. The FAA can, after a normal period of bureaucratic time will say, yes, well, we've considered it again, and no, there's no reason to change the rules, which means there'll be no improvement in airline seats. So if you want to fight with us, go back to court and start the process again.
Okay, so the FAA can't do anything about comfort. What about safety?
Yes, the FAA is empowered, and that is where the judge and the plaintiffs in this, which is a somewhat interesting, we don't need to go into it, flyers' rights group, hung their hats on, which is that the FAA is required to ensure for both health and safety of flights. And there is a rule that says the FAA must affirm that any seat layout on any aircraft of any size, anything more than what we call the commuter flights, you must be able to evacuate the plane within 90 seconds in an emergency situation. Now, the plaintiff, this flyers' rights organization, and virtually every person who writes about this, including myself, would say, when we're getting down to 28 inches of legroom and seats as narrow as 17 or 16 inches, that we really have questions whether you can do that. The FAA has said, yeah, no problem. We've done computer modeling. It's all fine. But they won't show us their work, as they used to say in high school when we did long division. It's all a secret, all protected by the government.
But they do computer modeling, as I understand it, because there are too many injuries when they try to do live tests?
And that seems to be some of the issues that the FAA has come across. That when and if you've never watched even a mock evacuation, you can have injuries, and that's not surprising because even in a good evacuation, if there's such a thing, in a real-life situation, you would have injuries. But the question remains, can you evacuate a plane? Say, let's look at something like an A380, which could handle up to 800 passengers. No U.S. carrier flies that plane. But U.S. carriers fly aircraft that carry 300 or more people. Can you, with so many seats squashed so close together, evacuate that plane in 90 seconds? The outside observers are saying, we have no proof you can do it. The government saying, well, our computer models say you can, and that's about as far as we're willing to go.
And the judge can't say, wait a minute, you can't do computer modeling, you got to show me?
Well, at least in this case, she did not. It might come to the fact. I mean, she was, as you say, there's no better word than the one you used to open this segment, blistering. Her opinion was brutal on the FAA. You didn't show your work. You don't have any real assumption of basic physics. You don't want to talk about this. You don't want to hear dissent. So go think about it some more. Now, if another case comes up, she might say better than go think about it some more. But at the moment, this still rests with the FAA, and they have shown no interest at all in wading into this.
Was there ever some golden age when the coach seats seemed like thrones?
Golden age is tricky because it depends on what you're looking at, price, access. It almost becomes, heaven forfend, the healthcare debate. But at the time of deregulation, which is now almost 40 years, okay, the average airline seat in coach was about 35 inches, 34 on the short side, and the seat width was about 18. Now, the seat that you're currently sitting in is probably about 21 or 22 inches wide. So even back then, the seats were narrower than perhaps you were comfortable with. But certainly today, you can't even get 35 and 18 in what the airlines sell as premium economy domestically. You're more around 34 and 17. So that's how dramatically things have happened. The things they sell you as extra legroom seats are even smaller than where we were 40 years ago.
Is there a tipping point where passengers say, I'm not going to fly anymore, I'm going to take the train?
I don't know, and I keep coming back to, well, you want to take Amtrak from New York to Los Angeles? And how's the train going to work for you between New York and London or Los Angeles and Shanghai? The options we have as travelers are limited. Do we come to a point where passengers will just say, I won't be a passenger anymore, I'll just stay home, I won't fly? Could be. But the 40-year history since deregulation is what passengers book first are cost. They look at price. They pay very little attention. In fact, there is an airline out there that routinely gives you 33 and even 34 inches of legroom. That's JetBlue. And while JetBlue is doing just fine, the other airlines have been able to ignore JetBlue fairly comfortably without worrying about losing too many passengers.
I was going to ask about that. There are fewer and fewer airlines, so at least we have one, JetBlue, that does seem to be competing, to some extent at least, for comfort. But I take it the others aren't.
Their line is, in both what they say to the public and to the security analysts at the quarterly earnings reports, is the passengers have spoken with their wallets. And even to qualify JetBlue, I've had the CEO of JetBlue stand in front of me and say, Joe, we don't want to be the best airline. We just want to be less bad than everybody else. So this, I mean, that is literally Robin Hayes, the CEO of JetBlue's comment to me. We're racing to the bottom here very quickly, and you could make the case, I don't want to make it too hard, but you could make the case that there's no indication that passengers are willing to step up from the bottom.
Every so often we hear that there are proposals for even smaller seats, seats that you don't really even sit down on. You just sort of, it's sort of like riding the bus and having to stand up.
As a New Yorker who uses the term strap hanger literally, although we now have bars, I would suggest that it might not come to that in the United States, and the U.S. has been where the planes have largely been manufactured and the regulatory agencies have had global sway. But when you look at a market like China, where there are more than 1.5 billion people and a fast-growing middle class, it's possible that the Chinese might say, well, we'll look at those kind of proposals, because if you fly on a daily basis between somewhere like Beijing and Shanghai, there are so many people flying so many flights, you will literally run out of airspace. So they're going to have to get bigger planes that squeeze even more people in. And at a certain point, a Chinese regulator might look at it and say, okay, we'll consider stand-up aircraft.
Has Congress taken any look at this?
Congress talks about a lot of things. And every proposal to regulate seat size for both either comfort or safety has died in committee. And in fact, the last major law passed in terms of safety had to do with the number of hours a pilot had to train before they could become a commercial airline pilot. And just in this session, some members of Congress, almost all Republicans, actually tried to get the minimum number of hours, which is 1,500 hours now, repealed. So there doesn't seem to be any interest in Congress in making our lives on a plane any better.
All right. Joe Brancatelli has the travel blog, joesentme.com. We sent for him. He showed up. And Joe Brancatelli, it's been great to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for
us.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.